Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our symposium, Hegemonic Narratives, Global, National and Local Dynamics of Memory Politics in Post-Conflict Societies. Today we organized with my colleague Johanna Wiss. My name is Jessie Barton-Hroneshova, and I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the Oxford Department of International Development. My main areas of focus is transitional justice, memory, and I have a regional expertise in Southeast Europe. My colleague Johanna is a postdoctoral fellow at Max Planck Institute and the Czech Academy of Sciences, and she mainly focuses on the dynamic relationship between collective identity and cultural collective memory, especially in Central Europe. I really warmly want to welcome you all to our session, which is going to be very long. We have two sessions today, morning and afternoon, with very distinguished speakers, and we're very, very pleased that a lot of them have joined us from all over the world. I suppose that is the upside of the current crisis, that we are actually able to invite speakers from Australia, the United States, without any additional cost, apart from sometimes timing issues. Our aim today is to study the socio-political aspects of memory, especially how various dominant or so-called hegemonic narratives are used and misused at the international, national, and local levels. I think we've all seen that interpretations of memory have resurfaced again as an important resource, both for political actors, as well as a mobilization resource that is being used in the public sphere. Today, we will discuss various cases from Northern Ireland, Central Europe, all the way to Brazil, as well as Afghanistan, which we will hear about a little bit more in the next session. Just a few housekeeping rules for today, and just to help you with the organization. All of the attendees, and I can now see that we've got 52 people online already. Thank you very much for being on time. So all of you are muted, which means your mics are off and your videos are not seen. All you can see currently are the speakers, are the panelists. During the panel sessions, you're not able to necessarily chat with the panelists. However, I would encourage you to ask questions in the Q&A, through the Q&A function, which you have at the bottom of your screens. From experience, again, I'd encourage you to ask the questions as soon as you can, because we do tend to get all the questions at the end of the panel, and then there's not enough time to actually answer the questions, because obviously we need to read them, engage with them, and then pose the panelists the questions. I would also encourage you during the coffee break and the lunch break, when you actually will have the chance to chat to the panelists, to ask additional questions, or if you have any clarifications, you can also use the chat function. But we will explain this as we go through the day and through the morning. I also want to encourage you to follow us on social media. If you're using Twitter, we have a Twitter hashtag for today, which is Hegenar, which is H-E-G-E-N-A-R. We will post it in the comments so that you can see it. And also you can follow me and Johanna on Jessinka or Johanna Wiss. Again, we will post it, as well as our departments and our sponsors. And let me say here that I really want to thank our sponsors, whose money in the end we didn't really need, but we're still very grateful that they were willing to sponsor us if this event was going to go offline. And that is the founder of my fellowship, Economic and Social Research Council. We want to thank the Max Planck Institute, the Czech Academy of Sciences. Obviously, I want to thank very much my department, the Oxford Department for International Development, that has helped with this organization. And we want to also thank Southeast European Studies Oxford, who's always been very supportive of all of our work. Before we go into our first keynote, and before Johanna actually tells you a little bit more about how we designed this program, I'd like to give the floor to the head of Department of International Development in Oxford, Diego Sanchez Ancochea, who's a very distinguished researcher that mainly works on the Global South and Latin America on issues such as inequality or industrial policies. And I ask him just to say a few words of welcome to all of you joining us from around the world. Diego, the floor is yours, or the virtual floor is yours.
Thank you, Jesse. I'm mute. Okay, I'm here. Thank you very much, Jesse. Thank you also for the distinguished part. I have to say that I don't feel distinguished at all, and even less in these times and ages, but I very much appreciate it. I am very happy to be here and to actually have the invitation to say the first few words. I have to say that I'm very sorry that I cannot say the words actually with you, all of you in Mansfield Road, because that would be much nicer and discussed, but it's actually a great opportunity anyway to welcome you all and to celebrate all the work that Jesse and Joanna have done. So as some of you will know, our department is very much concerned with the politics of development and thinking about the politics of development from a multidisciplinary perspective. So if you think about some of the topics we do, that goes from how people experience development to how global and local actors interact, to how problems are framed and reframed based on political calculations, or how we can build more inclusive and stable institutions. And I think, Jesse and Joanna will correct me, but that's partly what we will be actually discussing in many ways today, focusing very much on the role of memory in the way framing takes place, and framings are used but also abused in post-conflict societies. Of course, the issue of conflict and post-conflict itself has been at the center of the department. When I came in 2008, Francis Steward had a center on conflict and horizontal inequalities, but also Josh has done a lot of work in terms of conflict and post-conflict in a very different perspective than Francis, revealing all our diversity. And he has also supervised all kinds of doctoral students doing some of the same work. John Gledhill does now post-conflict work. And of course, this year we were fortunate to have Jesse for the whole year bringing many of these issues to here as well. And the conference doesn't just build on our unique tradition. For itself, including, for example, in the other side of my life in the Latin American Center, Andresa de Sousa, and from abroad. There's a second reason that I was glad Jesse gave me the opportunity to actually have the floor at the beginning, and is that this conference very much shows the role that postdoctoral fellows play in academia in general, but clearly in our department. I think one of the reasons I was very happy to become head of the department is very much to assist and support and even mentor the number of early career academics that we receive every year and that leads to all kinds of benefits from us, from the research to the dynamism, to the commitment to communicate in better and more original ways. Again, this conference is a good example. To the promotion of debate. I know very well, and I participate in all kinds of discussions at the moment of how, and these times are uncertain for everyone, but obviously particularly for early career academics. I don't want to start the conference with a pessimistic bent, but obviously from hiring freezes to a difficult labor market to growing demands on our time, life is slightly harder than it was just 3 months ago. But I am one of the people convinced as academic and as head of department that the academic world will only be successful if we are actually able to create spaces for early career academics to succeed, to grow, to create these kinds of conversations, and for all of us to benefit from their ideas, their dynamism, and their teaching experience. So I was glad to see the conference. I was glad that Jesse gave me the opportunity to welcome you all. And I promise, at least some of you, that we will be able to receive you at some other moment, hopefully soon, in Mansfield Road as well, where we will give you both not very good sandwiches, which is UK style, but also maybe a much better dinner, which is also Oxford style. So thank you, Jesse, very much, and good luck with the whole conference.
Thank you so much, Diego. That was really nice of you. And thank you for bringing in the current crisis a little bit in the picture, because I in a way brushed over it a little bit. Thank you. And so now I'd like to finally hand over to Johanna, my colleague Johanna Wiss, and a very good friend of mine, who is currently in London, but otherwise based at Max Planck and the Czech Academy of Sciences. She will not only say a few words about the program today and how we designed this conference, but she will also introduce our first keynote speaker that I know everyone's already waiting for. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jesse. Good morning and warm welcome to all our distinguished panelists and to the audience. We are very excited that this event, despite the current situation, is taking place today as originally scheduled, even though online and not in Oxford, as Diego mentioned. It was in early autumn when Jesse and I got together to organize and discuss the possibility to organize an event to bring together different scholars whose work inspires us in one way or another, and to discuss the topic we both are very passionate about, namely the politics of memory and the memory of politics. We wanted to reflect on how the past is being constructed for political purposes, especially in the context of different geographical locations and on different levels of society. And by doing so, we really ultimately wanted to further explore the intrinsic and dynamic relationship between memory, politics, and power. So firstly, in each panel, we wanted to have several countries and at least two different continents represented. The reason being that while we appreciate the uniqueness of each case study, we also very strongly believe that there are certain common dynamics, that there are certain shared features which become more obvious through juxtaposition. Secondly, the symposium is divided into three panels, each exploring different nexus between memory, power, and politics on different levels, on international, national, and local level. Again, we are very much aware that all these three levels interact simultaneously and that they are mutually reinforcing. But for organizational and for analytical purposes, we think that this distinction works particularly well on this occasion. So that's enough about the underlying ideas and logic of the symposium. And now please let me introduce our first keynote speaker, Sujatha Fernandez. Sujatha is a professor of political economy and sociology at the University of Sydney. Her work explores social and cultural movements, Black popular culture, and migrant workers, with a focus on the Americas. In her book, Curated Stories, The Uses and Misuses of Storytelling, about which she will tell us herself shortly, Sujatha looks at the uses of storytelling in a range of global movements, including campaigns by migrant domestic workers and undocumented youth. The book was published by the Oxford University Press, and Sujatha, the virtual floor is yours.
To unmute. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much to Jesse and Joanna for pulling all of this together, especially given the challenges of the current situation. Just as one of those examples of one of the challenges, my internet went out to this morning, and I was told it could be up to 48 hours. So I have a temporary modem, and we're all keeping our fingers crossed, hopefully, that it goes off without any hitches. But you'll know in case there's something that's the modem playing up. But thank you very much again. I'm very excited to be a part of this conference, and thank you also to the Department of International Development. All right, so I'm gonna share my presentation. So Malala Yousafzai grew up in the northwestern Swat district of Pakistan. about 50 miles from the Afghan border. She was the daughter of an educator who ran a chain of private schools in the area. When the militant Taliban group took over the Swat Valley and banned girls' education in 2008, the 11-year-old Malala was enlisted to write a blog under a pen name for the BBC, recounting her experiences. She spoke about education rights to American officials and to grassroots organizations. As Malala began to address national and international media, her identity was revealed and she received numerous death threats. On October 9, 2012, she was shot in the head by a Taliban gunman while returning home on a bus after taking an exam. She survived after numerous rounds of reconstructive surgery and rehabilitation, and went on to complete her schooling in Birmingham, England. In the wake of her shooting, Malala has been the recipient of numerous awards and honors, including the Nobel Peace Prize. She has received honorary citizenships and doctorates, was featured by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, has met with many heads of state, and has been the subject of a documentary, He Named Me Malala. She has been iconized as the girl who was shot by the Taliban for wanting to go to school. In the geopolitical cross currents of American military intervention in the Middle East, a rising wave of protest from the Arab revolutions, and criticism of the surveillance of Muslim populations in Western countries, Malala's story was one that could provide reassurance and comfort to a Western public that America was doing the right thing. Media pundits, politicians, and advocacy organizations worked to create an image of Malala as a symbol of women's rights under attack by the Taliban, a situation requiring Western military intervention. In constructing this narrative about Malala, talk show hosts and marketing teams glossed over Malala's opposition to the war, and they ignored her indictments of American intelligence agencies as having fostered the idea of jihad and arming the Taliban. She is presented as a deserving, empathetic subject, non-confrontational compared to the angry Muslims who dominate Western media coverage. The refashioning of Malala's story has become possible within an emergent culture of storytelling that presents carefully curated narratives with predetermined storylines as a tool of philanthropy, statecraft, and advocacy. Contemporary life is saturated with such initiatives, from the phenomenon of TED Talks and Humans of New York, to the plethora of story coaching agencies and strategists that have emerged to sustain this culture. It is no coincidence that the rise of this curated storytelling takes place in an era of Facebook, which a New Yorker article notes is a medium that promotes the quick and cavalier consumption of others. Just as Malala is depicted as a typical teen in the film, giggling at a picture of Brad Pitt, the popular stories in the news feeds and timelines of social media are those that are accessible. Histories, ambiguities, and political struggles are erased in an effort to create warm and relatable portraits of others who are just like us. Curated storytelling has extended deep into contemporary social life and political culture and institutions. The Harvard lecturer and political strategist Marshall Ganz was called upon in 2007 to provide storytelling workshops for Barack Obama's election campaign, and his public narrative trainings have since been used widely by advocacy organizations, nonprofits, NGOs, and immigrant rights groups. Tell your story has become an inspirational mantra of the self-help industry. Narrative research centers have emerged to look at the benefits of storytelling in a range of areas, from treating depression to helping new immigrants build community. Philanthropic organizations and foundations produce storytelling manuals and offer trainings to their grantees in nonprofit storytelling. The Department of Defense sponsors a project known as Narrative Networks, looking at the strategic implications of narrative for defense missions. And the US State Department has used story workshops as a means of cultural diplomacy in places like Afghanistan. What is behind this contemporary boom of instrumental storytelling? What accounts for the wide diffusion of a storytelling model as a set of globally available trainings, toolkits, and protocols? While most of the literature about storytelling has focused on the multiple gains to be had from telling stories, my work takes a more critical look at the storytelling boom. Alongside a broader shift to neoliberal and financialized economies, storytelling is being reconfigured on the model of the market to promote entrepreneurial self-making and is leveraged towards strategic and measurable goals driven by philanthropic foundations. Curated personal stories shift the focus away from structurally defined axes of oppression and help to diffuse the confrontational politics of social movements. Under what conditions do stories reproduce dominant relations of power, and when can they be subversive? What are the stakes and for whom in the crafting and mobilization of storytelling? Rather than being the magical elixir we imagine, might curated stories actually inhibit social change? Most of the scholarly and popular literature on storytelling extols the virtues of a prototypical and universal storytelling model, but it does not address the circuits of capital within which stories circulate, or the situation of storytelling within broader neoliberal transformations. In my book, Curated Stories, The Uses and Misuses of Storytelling, I use the concept of the political economy of storytelling to discuss the remaking of storytelling in a context of neoliberalism. The concept refers to two intertwined activities. The first is the production, circulation, and consumption of stories that are mobilized towards certain ends, such as the building of political capital of organizations and bolstering electoral goals, and the aims of imperial statecraft. Stories are structured through protocols and workshops to provide sound bites that can easily be delivered in a newspaper interview, voter recruitment drive, or a legal hearing. Disembedded from the social networks and everyday life of the storyteller, these stories are circulated in legislative and electoral campaigns and online forums. A political economy of storytelling is concerned with the conditions of the production of stories within neoliberal orders. The second activity involves the deployment of stories in processes of subject making. Scholars of literature have shown how under liberal modernity, the story form provided the technology by which social outsiders acquired the capacity to become citizen subjects. However, I draw on Foucaultian accounts of neoliberal subjectivity to understand how in a neoliberal era, as Nicholas Rose argues, subjects of role of rule are specified in a new way. Quote, as active individuals asked to enterprise themselves, to maximize their quality of life through acts of choice. The individual is seen as an active agent in the fabrication of their own existence. Curated storytelling is a means of producing neoliberal subjects guided by principles of upward mobility, entrepreneurship, and self-reliance. Those who participate in this self-making often have class aspirations of upward mobility, due to their educational opportunities, niche position in the economy, or their access to structures of funding. Yet despite the desire for individual personal advancement, the majority of those who tell their stories are not able to improve their conditions. This is one of the contradictions that could work to unravel the project of neoliberal subject making. In my talk today, I want to present a case of curated storytelling from the study of the online Afghan Women's Writing Project, the AWWP, a series of online creative writing workshops conducted by US-based mentors with Afghan women in English. In March 2010, with the Dutch government pulling out from the US-led war in Afghanistan, the CIA released a confidential memo calling for targeted manipulation of public opinion using stories by Afghan women. The subheading of the memo, Why Counting on Apathy Might Not Be Enough, refers to the indifference among the public in Germany and France that allowed these countries to send more troops, a strategy that might not be sustainable if there were more Afghan civilian casualties or public debates. Rather, the memo calls for the circulation of stories by Afghan women to humanize the military intervention and build support among Western European women for the war effort. The CIA memo points to the uses of storytelling in imperial statecraft with geopolitical strategy and intervention pursued not just through military aggression and economic pressure, but justified by emotional accounts of oppressed Afghan women victimized by the Taliban. In May of the previous year, a former staff member from the US Embassy in Kabul had set up the AWWP. The stories composed in the workshops are edited and published on their website and, judging by the comment section, are read mostly by women in the US and other Western countries such as Canada and Australia. The project was partly funded by the US State Department, which is not surprising given its resonances with the memo. The support for these initiatives reflect an embrace of soft power strategies within US foreign policy, as articulated by the political strategist Joseph Nye. Quote, "In today's information age, success is the result not merely of whose army wins, but of whose story wins." The idea of Afghan women speaking for themselves and telling their stories without mediation is central to the mission of the AWWP. In the history and mission statement on the website, AWWP founder Masha Hamilton says that in trying to learn about Afghanistan, she found that, quote, "the voices of women were primarily available only through the media or their men. We heard little from them directly," end of quote. The project is aimed at, quote, "allowing Afghan women to have a direct voice in the world, not filtered through male relatives or members of the media," end of quote. At a reading of Afghan women's poetry in Los Angeles in May 2014, executive director of the AWWP, Laurie Nowak, emphasized the unmediated nature of the story. She said, "It doesn't go through the media. It doesn't go through and approve something that their husband might have said. The stories go through the channel," end of quote. "The stories go through the channels of AWWP and are published on the website where people around the world can read them. And," says Nowak, "you know right then that's what the women in Afghanistan are really thinking," end of quote. This discourse of authenticity is central to the project, that these are true stories by real Afghan women. But such language conceals the ways in which the stories are strongly mediated through the framing of the workshops, the selection of the writers, the requirements of funding bodies, and the structure of the workshops. All of these factors shape the voice of Afghan women that appears on the website. The case of the AWWP illustrates the uses of storytelling in imperial statecraft. Telling and publishing stories by Afghan women is a way to amplify certain moderate voices within Afghanistan at a time when the US was facing growing resistance to its role in interventionist wars. Those Afghan women who oppose US intervention, campaign against the US-supported warlords in the parliament, and seek to promote self-determination and economic independence for Afghanistan are further marginalized politically. Grappling with and analyzing empirical details requires suturing a Foucaultian account of neoliberal subjectivity with Marxian and Gramscian accounts of class formation, agency, and contradiction. Through telling their stories, Afghan women did not only present themselves as individual strivers, but they were encouraged to see themselves in class terms as part of a new and elite class strata. Gramscian frameworks that focus on processes of class formation give us the tools to understand how these actors were integrated into strategies developed by dominant groups. I use Gramsci's concept of transformismo to discuss how storytelling was part of a broader strategy in the Obama era to draw Muslim populations and others into projects of advocacy, civic education, and electoral participation, and to absorb and demobilize mass anti-war and migrant rights protests. The focus on class strategies allows us to locate agency not simply within an order of reason, but in the actual actors themselves, all acting according to their own sets of logics and constraints within a shifting field. AWWP mentors encouraged Afghan women to use their stories to promote voting in the controversial national elections in Afghanistan in 2014. Rather than mass mobilizations that could put pressure on the government and challenge the broader conditions of exploitation, storytelling activities narrowed the field of action to the voting booth and legislature, thereby reducing the range of independent actions available to groups. At a time of growing concern about the role of the US as human rights violator and aggressor, both domestically and abroad, the stories were also used to promote the image of the US as a benefactor nation. Afghan women and the readers of their stories often reinforced images of the US as a global crusader for women's rights. By tying stories to electoral campaigns and by reinterpreting them through the lens of nationalist mythologies, a range of groups participated in a process of transformismo that absorbed and diffused the discontent being expressed globally and domestically toward American-supported neoliberal and imperialist policies. The Gramscian lens allows us to understand not just how power is produced, but also the contradictions inherent in class strategies that can enable forms of resistance. Sometimes these tensions crystallize into overt critiques. The AWWP had a few writers and readers who criticized the US government for killing Afghans with impunity while claiming to help the country. Afghan writers pointed out the opportunism of Western human rights and feminist networks, which glorify a few cases of Afghan women attacked by the Taliban while ignoring others. And one reader objected to the whole enterprise of Westerners trying to read Afghan women's stories online with no context and no sense of their own implication in the abuses that take place. The tensions, criticisms, and refusals show the process of neoliberalization through storytelling as much more contested and flexible than Foucaultian accounts have allowed for. The concept of neoliberal governmentality is crucial to understand how certain kinds of curated stories have emerged in tandem with a free market economy. But this governmentality itself is open to challenge and reformulation. Although neoliberalism may be ascendant, it is not seamlessly reproduced. Disaggregating actors, logics, and class processes through my empirical investigations has been one way to show the contested and contradictory ways that neoliberalism is created and recreated. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sujatha, for this wonderfully rich, thought-provoking presentation. I really enjoyed the richness of the examples. So we have now approximately 12 minutes for Q&A, and while members of the audience gather their thoughts and pose the questions through the Q&A function, let me take advantage of my role as a chair and go first. What is it about stories that makes them so relatable? What is it about stories that makes them also such a powerful tool how to influence others?
So I think the powerful thing about stories is that they speak to us emotionally, right? They speak to us emotionally, individually, personally. We hear a story and it's different to hearing a whole series of statistics, which just tell us, you know, what has happened. They give us a narrative about it, but they don't connect us with that narrative through our emotions, through our feelings, and on a very individual sense. And I think that's both the power and the peril of stories, right? Because the problem I'm kind of sort of outlining with the ways stories, curated stories, have come to be used is that it's precisely they individualize problems that are structural, that are collective, and that are broader than the individual. But by sort of coming to see this in terms of, you know, the evil Taliban, Afghan man in the household treating his daughter in a particular way, we have a much narrower sense through these kinds of stories of actually what's happening. Now, I don't think that this is intrinsic to stories themselves, and I think we can think of many examples of very powerful stories that can pay attention to broader structures, that can get at the sort of depth of problems, but they're also stories are also vulnerable to being used in this way.
Thank you. We have a question from Olga Repnik. The question is, I wonder if some of the books of Khaled Hosseini are actually based on Afghan women storytelling, especially A Thousand Splendid Sons. Thank you.
You know, that's a really interesting question. I haven't read any of his books, and I'm not sure if the question is asking if his storytelling is similar to the kind of storytelling found in the Afghan Women's Project, or, you know, where that storytelling is coming from. But unfortunately, because I haven't read any of his books, I can't really compare it to the AWWP project. But I think that would be a really interesting thing to do, is to actually sort of look at some of these narratives within literature. Someone like Laila Abu Lugod has done that in her book on, it's called, I think, Are Muslim Women Worth Saving? She looks at popular narratives of Afghan women and compares them to these kind of narratives. These are more coming from official institutions. But unfortunately, since I haven't read it, not too sure on that.
Thank you. in relation to the structure and theme of this symposium, is it possible to say that stories function slightly differently on international, national, and grassroots level? Is there something specific about each of these levels and something which all these stories share?
So one of the things that I argue in my book is that what's so interesting about what I'm calling curated stories is that they seem to follow a global template. And one of the things that I do in the book is I trace the origins and the emergence of this global template. And I trace the origins of them to the sort of human rights commissions of the 1980s, the truth commissions in Latin America and South Africa and various places where a more sort of radical social movement storytelling that we might think of, you may have heard of Rigoberta Menchú in Guatemala, or people who told stories with the aim of sort of trying to foment radical social change, how through the process of the truth commissions in the 1980s, that gets shifted into eventually a more kind of what I'm talking about, neoliberal storytelling, the curated storytelling. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the question as I was, if you can remind me the question.
Right. My question was really about the three different levels which we work in, in the symposium.
Yes. So what I'm interested in looking at this global template. So out of these truth commissions, we begin to see this type of curated storytelling adopted beyond that and going into all kinds of movements. And so I look at in the US, for instance, I see one of the master templates coming out at the time of the election in 2008 of Barack Obama, that his election strategist came up with a template, and then that template, after he was elected, was kind of dispersed and used by immigrant rights groups, environmental groups, all different kinds of organizations. And it was kind of manufactured on a national level and then global level. So some of the same protocols and trainings used in the US began to be used all over the world. And one of the things I look at is I look at the similarities between them, and there is quite a bit of similarity. So in terms of these different levels, I'm interested in how one case can become nationalized. It can also go to the global level, to Afghanistan, right, to Australia, where I am, but then how it's also interpreted and used at the very grassroots level.
Thank you so much. We have two more questions. First came from Alex Martins. So what do you think the long-term psychological and otherwise effect of this type of storytelling as imperialist statecraft are on populations, both in countries experiencing conflict and in Western countries that perpetuate the wars?
Yeah, so I think there are sort of effects in both of those contexts. So if we take, for instance, the AWWP, I think that the effect that it has had is to kind of encourage the formation of these, what I call these neoliberal subjectivities. So these kind of entrepreneurial subjects, the young, upwardly mobile Afghan women who's educated, who aspires to sort of be Western, right? Who aspires to Western concepts of marriage, of personhood, of being a career woman. And in writing these stories, and they're a very select group, these women are selected from US educational institutions within Afghanistan. So they're already an elite, literate, educated sector of the population, upwardly mobile, friendly to the United States. But the women who are doing this are, and you know, these stories are not being read by the majority of people in Afghanistan because they're in English, right? So that straight away tells us who the audience is. The audience is mostly the women writing the stories who are developing a sense of themselves as Western-oriented entrepreneurial subjects. And then the women in Western countries. And it's really interesting how the women who are reading these stories in Western countries and commenting on these stories are themselves developing a concept of themselves, the psychological, as the person said, developing a sense of themselves as living in a post-feminist society. Because they read the stories of the poor, oppressed Afghan woman in this conflict zone, being oppressed by the Taliban, and they say, I'm so lucky that my society has resolved issues of patriarchy, that I no longer have to deal with a man treating me that way, that I can go out, wear whatever I want, be sexually liberated, wear a bikini at the beach if I want to, and express love to my partner without any threat that I'm going to be killed, right? So it's having a psychological impact for the women reading these stories and thereby coming to think of themselves as somehow having superseded feminism, superseded patriarchy, and living in a post-feminist society.
Thank you. Catherine Gilbert is asking, can you say a little bit more about the specificity of women's voices in these curated stories? Are women's stories curated differently to men's stories?
I guess I'm just trying to think, because in this chapter of the book, I did, you know, it was all women, so there wasn't really any men's stories as such to compare them with, because it's the Afghan Women's Writing Project. And I'm trying to think, most of the chapters in my book are looking at women's stories. One of the things that I do is I compare Afghanistan with Venezuela, for instance, and I look at storytelling in under Chavez, Hugo Chavez, in Venezuela in the early 2000s, which is another place where I did quite a bit of field research. And now I guess we could refer to Venezuela as a conflict zone as well, even though the time when I did my field research there, it was not at that point something would be considered a conflict place. But there I looked, for instance, at the stories the narrative of Hugo Chavez himself. I looked at his autobiography, and I think for me what was interesting was that the men's story and the way in which it's told is told very much in an epic format. Like there wasn't so much about, and I guess I should be a little careful here, because I did find men's stories in Venezuela that were not told in this epic format, that were also very particular and specific as compared to the epic narrative which we saw with someone like Chavez, who talked about, you know, his spiritual awakening, his ideological awakening, his you know, reaching a point of consciousness changing, and then like the next minute sort of entering into his historic role in the world. And I think when I'm looking at a lot of the women's stories, they were more focused on the everyday, they were more focused on the domestic sphere, they were more focused on the space of the barrio. And like I said, there were men's stories in Venezuela I found like that as well. So I'm not sure that that's, you know, necessarily a fixed gender distinction that I want to make, but I am, you know, curious that there are certain ways in which stories can also be kind of masculinized or feminized as well.
Well, there is another very fascinating question, but I'm afraid that the time is up as the first panel is about to begin. So we will send you the question later, so you can maybe answer it in writing if it's possible. Thank you again for joining us today, Sujata. Many thanks to the audience as well for your attention and these challenging questions. And Jesse, over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation, Sujata.